Hello, and thanks for joining us once again at theoneliner.com. This is the second of our podcasts from the Edinburgh International Film Festival 2010. I'm Scott. No, that's not right. I'm not Scott. Scott.
You've prepared very badly for this, haven't you? You've not even got your basic identity sorted.
I must be envied. I am most decidedly not Scott. I'm Drew. I do believe Scott, however, is Scott.
Hello.
We have 7 films to cover tonight, so rather than beating about the bush, we shall plough straight through it. Scott.
First up is Cherry Tree Lane, which is a film choice I made based more or less on the reputation of the director here. Paul Andrew Williams was responsible for the well-regarded London to Brighton. It had slipped my mind that he was also responsible for the, let's charitably say, less well-regarded The Cottage.
Oh, dear.
Yes, this explains quite a lot. But anyway, in this film, in a house on Cherry Tree Lane, a middle-aged couple settle down to a meal together while going through a minor argument, or at least a resigned discussion, about the foibles of the relationship and character flaws. This all progresses in a slightly dull but adequate kitchen sink drama sort of way. It's really only about a social class removed from a Ken Loach film. The film takes a sudden turn when a group of 3 hoodie-clad youths barge into their home, have them bound and gagged, then make themselves at home while waiting for the couple's son to return. It seems that he has squealed to the cops on something, resulting in one of the young thug's family members going to jail. This is supposed to be payback calling. Even the above basic information has to be teased out over what feels like about 7 hours. I suppose the idea was to build tension by having the motivations for the teen's actions be mysterious for a decent length of time while the couple get significantly more terrified as the ordeal goes on and, in the father's case, badly beaten. It's well acted enough, I suppose, at least on the part of the adults, who have a difficult job to do. But you have to question what's going on with the attempts on the parts of at least 2 of the young thugs to humanise themselves somewhat by distancing themselves from the barely human leader of the gang. It's not like I have any need or motivation to distinguish or care about the various shades of thug involved in the film. So it doesn't work all that well, as it does mean that for a good chunk of the running time, the film revolves around 3 little shits arguing about biscuits while 2 duct tape people whimper. Things eventually escalate somewhat later on, but by that point any attempt to build tension had been smothered by the tedium. Now, this is just about the most middle-class attempt at a thriller-cum-horror that I've ever seen. It seems to be custom-built to appeal to Daily Mail readers. The general theme of the nice, stable professionals being terrorised by those scabby, scruffy lower classes has been knocking around for a while, and I've done my best to avoid them because I had a horrible suspicion that it would be horrendously forced and trite and socially irresponsible. In this case, I think I was right. This doesn't really do anything more than tap into tabloid hysteria that, if you go by crime figures rather than number of sensationalist headlines are to believe, is entirely unwarranted. This is just an additional reason to dislike Cherry Tree Lane, but the main reasons not to bother with it is that it's really dull and not even remotely terrifying, meaning that it fails at everything that it tries. So yes, avoid.
Yes, I would very much agree with that. Even if you set aside the Daily Mail-esque politics, it's just not scary. It's not unsettling, it's not thrilling, it's very, very mundane, it's glacially paced, you don't really care about any of the characters in any way whatsoever, apart from by the end you just more or less like all of the nice little people involved to get an axe in the face. But yeah, it's just a very slow, dull film. It's not scary. Gladly avoid it. Right, next on to Japan for My Miracle. Now, a few countries' animated output seems to get childhood like Japan's, and the obvious kings of the hill are Studio Ghibli, and My Miracle's director Sunao Katabuchi worked at the legendary studio as an assistant director to Hayao Miyazaki on the excellent Kiki's Delivery Service, so his background is very promising indeed. Set in the Japan of 1955, where the country is still recovering from war, and much of the population lives a very low-tech life, My Miracle is an evocation of the joy of childhood and the power of imagination. Shinko spends her free time running through the fields around her house, imagining them as they were 1,000 years ago, when they were the site of the capital of the land of Suo, replete with palaces and princesses. Shinko befriends the new girl at school, Kiko, and teaches her the histories taught to her by her grandfather, and how to use the magical power of imagination to bring it all to life. Now, there's no strong plot here. It's really about friendship and the wonder of childhood, though the darker adult world does creep in places, which here, though, is something of a problem. Adult issues that affect children and the realities of life like death definitely have a part in this genre. They often even make the film better and more powerful, but I question the wisdom of introducing illegal gambling dens and the Yakuza into a children's film. However, it is painted with charm and soul in a palette of pastel colours. The influence of Miyazaki can clearly be seen in Katabuchi's work, though the story is neither as polished nor compelling as the great man's work, and is really blown out of the water by Miyazaki's own release of the same year, Ponyo. But if you like anime, then it's definitely worth catching. There's never anything like enough of it shown in British cinemas, something which constantly disappoints me, and you should jump on a chance to see this if Japanese animation is your bag.
Ah, sounds good. I'd probably disagree with the gangsters not having a place in children's animation, though I think Kiki's Underground Gambling Den has a good ring to it. I'd sign up for that. Onwards to Germany for Snowman's Land. I am, like all good-hearted people, a sucker for a pun in a film title, so this was right up my alley. Two scruffy German hitmen are contacted to head off into the snowy wilds of Eastern Europe on a mysterious assignment. On reaching the location they're told to get to, they find it to be a nearly deserted aging hotel somewhere to the left of the middle of nowhere. The mysterious, near-legendary hitman Berger, who has dragged them out here, is nowhere to be seen, but his girlfriend Sybil is still kicking around, well, when she's not running the designer drug kitchen in the basement, or off on 3-day round trips that shopping entails from this remote locale. The two hitmen, Walter and Mickey, don't have much of a clue while they're there for a while, and matters are complex enough before Berger even shows up. Mickey takes it on himself to seduce Sybil, however an accidental firearm discharge instead sees her very, very dead. Disposing of the body in the nick of time, Berger shows up with his hired goon, Kazik, to tell them why their services had been retained. Turns out that Berger has plans to turn this area into an exclusive ski resort, hampered only by a small local population, the main growth industry of whom is in brigandry. They seem to be gathering forces to retake the hotel and restaurant that Berger has bought, and the current plan is to hold the fort for a few days until a small mercenary force appear to clean up. Of course, plans always change, especially given the disappearance of Sybil. This causes tensions between the group and things devolve from there. Now, Snowman's Land may not be the defining dramatic work of our generation, but it's a darn good yarn. The first half hour or so brings back memories of Takeshi Kitano's Sonatine, at least in as much as it seems to revolve around the general theme of gangsters on holiday. When things get a little more serious, it's solidly constructed, and the characters are more than interesting enough to carry the narrative. Given that all of the characters are various blends of contract killers, thugs and murderers, they aren't particularly likeable in the traditional sense. Still, the early doors banter between Mickey and Walter shows a decent level of wit, and they manage to be just human enough to build some small degree of sympathy for them when things start to go very badly for the pair, as it inevitably does. This isn't a tale of ultra-smooth criminal operators, and it's all the better for it. Snowman's Land also doesn't plough down a particularly serious path either, shying away from exploring the morality of these people in favour of a more roustabout comic style. The tone works far more often than it doesn't, and there's a good number of blackly comic laughs to be had in here. Is it worth travelling to the snowbound middle of nowhere yourself to get hold of? Well, perhaps not, but it's a well-crafted and entertaining film that deserves to find an audience. If you happen across it, I would certainly recommend taking the time to see it.
Okay, next we come home to Britain with the animated Jack Boots in Whitehall. Now, I'd like you to imagine a world where Scotland is an unknown barbaric place. Okay, perhaps that doesn't take a massive feat of imagination. And England stands alone against Germany in the Second World War. The evacuation of Dunkirk has failed, and the Germans' invasion of the Sceptred Isle is imminent. Having tried and failed by land and sea, those ingenious Nazis finally succeed by tunnelling beneath the Channel and rolling their tanks right out into Trafalgar Square. And further imagine, if you will, that the Europe of the 1940s is peopled by Barbie dolls, action men and various other humanoid toys. And there you have Jack Boots in Whitehall, a decidedly idiosyncratic stop-motion animation from first-time writer-director team Rory and Edward McHenry. Now imagine next that a ragtag group of soldiers, American volunteer airmen, country yokels and a farm labourer with abnormally large hands rescue Winston Churchill from London and retreat to the lawless waste of Scotland to make their final stand. Of course, what you can't imagine and need me to tell you is whether this film is worthy of your time. Alas, the answer is a fairly resounding no. The animation style, while distinctive and initially amusing, loses its novelty fairly quickly, and it runs out of steam on the jokes front pretty soon too. It's funny for about 15 minutes, and the story of Jack Boots and Whitehall, if story can be called, simply isn't compelling or entertaining enough to hold your interest, though accent fans may find some diversion in counting the number of accents employed during the film by Ewan McGregor. Those who don't want to know the final score should stop listening now. The number of accents used by Ewan McGregor is all of them. The film, or parts at least, I can see working as perhaps in an episodic format online. And had it been funnier, the animation is also very much the sort of thing that wouldn't have felt at all out of place on Channel 4's The Adam and Joe Show 10 years ago. But as a feature film in a cinema? No. Sorry. Doesn't pass muster. Give it a miss.
Yeah, it's just not very good, is it? I think it was aiming for a kind of Team America World Police sort of vibe, but it just falls short. It's just a variety of increasingly laboured pop culture references and fart noises and tongue-in-cheek racism, and it just sort of stops after about half an hour and doesn't get going again. It's a shame. I really, really want you to like this film. From the start, is really funny for like 10, 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah, it really is. It's quite disappointing, but by the end, the disappointment's gone and it's become kind of irritating.
Yeah, the only thing that I really liked was some of the character design, the wild-eyed, terrifying clergyman.
Yeah, Richard E. Grant's vicar, he was a scary character.
Yeah, and I think it was Himmler that looked like one of the melting Nazis at the end of Indiana Jones films. That was quite interesting, but the rest of it, it just simply isn't funny enough to warrant the running time. It's a good short that's been stretched out too badly. Staying in Britain, the annoyingly uncapitalised and unspaced film Brilliant Love. Two 20-somethings, Manchester, played by Liam Brown, and Noon, played by Nancy Trotter Landry, are in love. They live in a dilapidated garage, and the two express their love in very physical ways, often. Manchester often photographs the act, and the pair live a sort of hippie-ish lifestyle, inasmuch as all they seem to do is drink, get drugged up, steal food, and screw each other, which is nice work if you can avoid it. They go about their annoying lifestyle, boning and recanting sexual fantasies to the interests of no one, until almost by accident some plot interjects itself into the proceedings. Manchester accidentally leaves some prints of their proclivities in a pub, which are found conveniently enough by a local pornographer. He thinks that Manchester might have a career in the erotic arts, and a local art exhibitor is keen to put on a show. Stress is supposed to show in the relationship as Manchester weighs up whether to sell Noon's trust in service of a career and money, but Manchester is such a space cadet that there's no real sense of anything that's going on in his head, and given that both the leads are uniformly irritating, I have no real interest in them anyway. I'll get the positive thing out of the way first. The leads and director Ashley Horner capture the careless, reckless nature of young love pretty well. Everything else is a unique blend of banal, boring, pretentious and infuriating. The pair of the leads, but Manchester in particular, are a can of Pabst Blue Ribbon away from appearing in a photo gallery on lookatthisfuckinghipster.com. The dialogue on occasion veers into the utterly laughable. The first line of this film is something like, "Last winter I found a needle in a haystack. It pricked my finger and filled me full of love." My gut reaction at this point was to walk out in disgust, and retrospectively, my gut was looking out for me.
Yeah, I felt a sudden surge of hatred after you mentioned that there.
But even if you were to ignore by some superhuman effort how annoying these characters are, there's nothing even remotely interesting said by the film. The take-home message appears to be that you can't publicly display naked pictures of your girlfriend without her knowledge, without repercussions. Gee, thanks for that. Just like the previous sex-obsessed shit porn Nine Songs, there's an awful lot of flesh on display, and just like Nine Songs, this is a total smokescreen to distract you from how empty and vapid the film truly is. At one point when Manchester is initially showing his snapshots of Noon Beast with two backings to the art dealer, in what I suppose was a jab at over-interpretation of art, starts whittering on about the rawness and the rejection of artificial lighting and so on, hoping to raise a chuckle at the art world's occasional pretension. At least I think that's what was going on. I was too busy resetting my irony detector to pay much attention at that point. There's also a strange obsession with urination, given that there's about 5 instances of alfresco pissing, which is 5 too many as far as I'm concerned. The only boundaries this film is pushing is my tolerance for worthless, needlessly anachronistic, poorly written unerotica with characters that I wish would die in a house fire. Not highly recommended.
Funnily enough, is there any explanation for why the two main characters have such spectacularly stupid names?
They're fucking hipsters.
Sounds about right. The only problem I have with that film, I've not seen this, is I'm very slightly jealous because I haven't seen anything at this film festival yet that I can consider a true low point that I can really rail against. That's a very strange thing to say, but sometimes almost refreshing to have something really, really terrible so you can gauge everything else by it.
Yeah, it's good to have an absolute zero reference point, isn't it?
Yeah, although I think perhaps just knowing how little I would enjoy such a film, perhaps I could make do without it. On to the good old US of A now, and Barry Mundy. Now that's Barry Mundy, not Barry Mundy, the Asian sea bass. And this is a film about a man named Barry. Now this Barry, he likes the ladies. A lot. Not all of them like him, mind you, but he tries so often and so hard that he gets more than his fair share. Alas, he isn't always the best decision maker, and the results of 2 of his brief encounters with the opposite sex irreversibly change his life. The second results in his castration by trumpet, an event so traumatic he has no memory of it, which I reckon is probably just as well. The first, which he also has no memory of, though this time due to copious amounts of alcohol, doesn't come to affect him until after his fateful encounter with the brass instrument, when he learns that one of his last conquests resulted in a pregnancy. The rest of the film is fairly straightforward. Barry must grow up, take responsibility for the child, stop lazing around at work, and generally learn to straighten up and fly right. What makes it worth watching and sets aside from many other films is a strong ensemble cast, though far too little use of Sybil Shepherd and Malcolm McDowell as the matching clothes-wearing parents of Ginger, the mother of his baby, for my liking, and a strong central performance from Watchmen's Patrick Wilson, who makes the pathetic, lazy, and decidedly sleazy Barry still sympathetic and likeable. The most obvious comparison you could make to another film is with Knocked Up. Both deal with an immature man forced to grow up due to impending fatherhood, though Barry Mundy is both gentler and more serious. Knocked Up is the more successful film. In the long run, it's more entertaining and definitely funnier. But Barry Mundy is an entirely agreeable way to spend an hour and a half and observes enough truths to give you something to ponder for at least a short while afterwards. So this is definitely one worth catching.
Staying in America for Diane Bell's Obsolidia. Now, often at film festivals, you're going to be exposed to films with concepts so delicate they'd shatter the moment you look at them. Obsolidia looked as though it may well have been one of them. It centres on a librarian, George, played by Michael Piccirilli, who in his free time is collating an encyclopedia of obsoleted things, taping interviews with, say, silent movie projectionists, and transcribing their thoughts on by typewriter. The real beat of the film comes from a burgeoning relationship between George and that there silent movie projectionist, Sophie, played by Gaynor Howe. George doesn't exactly give off a great deal of confidence with that whole talking to women deal, despite Sophie's obvious interest in him. Her curiosity was piqued by his encyclopedian endeavours, and the two seem to share a common interest in what I imagine most people would happily characterise as weird old shit. Narratively, there's not a great deal more to talk about in the film. It is, in the main, a character piece, so it's good that the central characters are interesting enough to more or less warrant their presence in the film. There's a good chemistry between Gaynor Howe and Michael Piccirilli, and Piccirilli in particular gives a captivating performance as the quirky, geek-chic leading man. The cinematography is very impressive, massively impressive actually. So far it's certainly the most beautifully shot film I've seen at the festival, which I suppose goes some way to ameliorate its sliding into preachy eco-messagism that never comes across as anything less than a complete distraction to what the main thrust of the film is. Now, for at least the first hour or so of Obsolidia, I was completely on board with it. It's a mix of interesting characters with viewpoints that hadn't occurred to me, make for an entertaining and enjoyable watch, with dialogue that manages the difficult double whammy of being intelligent and more or less realistic. It kinda falls apart on the final stretch for me, not disastrously enough to ruin the film, but just enough to take the luster off it. For a film that's had no real attempt at or need for drama, the final act kicking the teeth for George seems somewhat out of place and simply there to give the piece some sort of definitive conclusion that for once it could probably have got away without bothering with. But that niggle aside, there's a lot to like in Obsolidia. And it's one of the better crafted movies to feature in this year's film festival. It's definitely worth a look, I would say.
I would agree wholeheartedly, to the point I have nothing of merit to add to that. It's very good. Go and see it. Right, that's all from us for this podcast. We will be back in short order with some more films from the IFF. And as always, you can get into contact with us if you wish at podcast@theoneliner.com. And until then, goodbye.